I was born in 1935. I came to North Carolina in 1964 to teach English at Davidson College. I had an AB in English from Princeton, and I had a PhD from Harvard. And my field was modern drama, and my specialty was modern plays. Sometime during the late 60s and early 70s, I began writing poetry. I was not a poet in college.
What made you want to put pen to paper and write a poem?
What happened, and I think some of the people at the church know this, maybe most of the people at the church know this, in 1967, after we had been at Davidson for 3 years, our young daughter died very unexpectedly. She was just short of her fourth birthday. And I had, because of my own childhood and because of my own past experience, kept emotion out of my life to keep myself calm and in control. And I worked very hard, but I did not have the language for grief. I didn't have the language for loss. I didn't have the language for feelings. And I think teaching English is one thing and doing it is another thing. And I needed to find the language in which I could express my feelings. And it took me really 10 years to retrain myself as a writer. I started writing short stories and I started writing poetry because poetry is the language of the soul. Poetry is the language of the heart. And often I think PhDs tend to be very intellectual, but I needed to get in touch with that other side of myself. What do you call it? The right brain?
Left brain, right brain.
Left brain, right brain. I had to build that part of myself. And I began very slowly writing poetry in the early 70s and writing fiction. And I found that poetry enabled me to get back in touch with my whole life, with not only with my daughter and with my feelings about her, but with my mother and father, with my sister, with my biological family, whom I had left when I married and had my own family. So I began writing poetry. I didn't publish my first book of poems until 1989, which is pretty late for poetry. In other words, I was, I think, 54 when it was called The Girl in the Yellow Raincoat was the name of my first poetry book. And the title poem is a reference to a poem I wrote in memory of my daughter. And then I became involved with the North Carolina Poetry Society and with the North Carolina Writers Network, which actually now has its base here in Winston-Salem. Ed Southern is, I don't know if you know Ed.
Sure.
So I began getting involved with the network. I was president of the network. I became president of the Poetry Society. And I would go around the state reading my poems and meeting other people who were writing. So, and then I began teaching creative writing at Davidson and became director of the creative writing program at Davidson until I retired. So I continued to teach drama, but poetry and fiction were very, very deeply a part of my life from about the, I would say, late 70s on.
Can you recall a short poem from The Girl in the Yellow Raincoat? Could you share with our listeners?
I could recite the title poem, which is a poem I'm very much known for.
I would appreciate that.
Okay. I got to take a breath. The Girl in the Yellow Raincoat. The girl in the yellow raincoat waits on the sidewalk outside my window. The flower in her hair is wet. She stands very still, her eyes focused upward on some object I cannot see. She does not move, but she smiles slightly. Perhaps she plays the cello, and she is humming Bartok silently, making the bow ripple with her tongue against her teeth. Or maybe she is waiting for a bus to take her to her lover. Or she has read a letter from Paris or Istanbul, and she smells coffee and chestnut steam roasted, and she hears in the cobbled streets the cries of vendors under the aged curves of bridges. Perhaps she's just a girl, standing in the rain in the early morning by a stone bench while the street shines. It is nothing, you argue. Then why do I weep? And why are there splinters in my palms? And why do I stand here long, long after she is gone? Whew.
Wow.
Was the sort of major turning point of my life, as becoming a poet, being able to express that feeling of what my daughter might have been like at the age of 18, which she would have been when I wrote this poem, would have been a freshman at Davidson.
Mm.
I continue to write poems about her at different ages. So in 2013, she would have been 50. So I owe her a poem for her 50th birthday in May.
Isn't that the beautiful thing about poetry? Kwame Dawes was talking. No, it was Fred Chappell talking about how you poetry is one of those things you can just look at a moment in time and from 360 degrees. Nothing else can do that.
No, I think that's exactly right. It's the moment, and you know it. If you write poetry, you know there's a poem here. I've got to do this poem, this moment, this. Fiction exists over time. Fiction is a sequence of events over time with a lot of cause and effect. but poetry is just that moment detailed and brought alive. Yeah, exactly.
You were alluding to how you work these experiences into your curriculum, for lack of a better way of putting that, just before we heard that poem. Talk about your work at Davidson, how in terms of creative writing you share
well,
your...
Well, what happened was that Davidson didn't have a creative writing program. We were bringing in a teacher from Charlotte, from Queens University, a guy named Paul Newman, who came in once a week and met with the students. And that was clearly not what our students needed. They needed someone who was there full time. And I had just begun to write poetry. I had gone to Breadloaf, to the writers' conference up at Middlebury College. It's a great writers' conference. And I went to the department, I think 1978, and said, I'd like to teach the creative writing class. And they said, okay. Well, one of the first students I ever had was a young woman named Patricia Cornwell. And Patsy, her name was Patsy Daniels then, Patricia Daniels. And she was an incredible student, a very, very, very disciplined writer. And she came to me one day and she said, Dr. Abbott, I'd like to do English honors. And I said, that's wonderful. She said, I'd like you to be my advisor. I said, that's wonderful. She said, I'd like to write a novel. I said, well, you can't do that. And she said, why not? I said, because it's never been done. Because all English honors theses had always been scholarly, analytical studies of literature. And I said, creative writing had been up to this point considered essentially an extracurricular activity. So she said, well, why don't you take it to the department? That's Patsy. She would never give up on anything that she wanted. She was absolutely determined. So I took it to the department, and they said yes. And that was really the beginning of what I would call the creative writing track in our major, which has developed over the last 30 years. Mm. So I began teaching creative writing. And then a wonderful alumnus named John McGee gave us a writing professorship so that we could bring in a visiting writer each year for a semester. And then we hired an African-American woman who's also a novelist named Brenda Flanagan, and Cynthia Lewis teaches creative nonfiction. And then when I retired, Alan Michael Parker took my place. And now we have really four or five people who are doing creative writing at Davidson. So it really began back there in 1978 with Patsy asking to do, and she did a thesis and she did a novel, and the novel was tucked away privately somewhere. Then she married Charles Cornwell, who was an English professor at Davidson. After she graduated, she married him. And they went off to Richmond, and he decided he wanted to be a minister. And Patsy got a job in Richmond in the morgue studying, forensic pathology, which became the basis for all these Scarpetta novels. So that's how it all started. And I began teaching creative writing. I also teach in the interdisciplinary humanities course. And I designed a course I've always been interested in religious themes in literature. It was the subject of my PhD thesis, which was called Shaw and Christianity. And I've studied how Shaw treats Christianity in his plays. And I developed a course called Three Contemporary American Prophets. That's P-H-E-T-S, not F. And it was about Flannery O'Connor, Frederick Buechner, and Walker Percy. And I taught this course until I retired. And somebody at Centenary heard about this. And I started going into Charlotte. I would go mostly to the Presbyterian churches, you know, First Pres in Charlotte, the Covenant Church in Charlotte, Myers Park. And I started doing these Wednesday night lectures because a lot of churches have Wednesday night programs. And the word got to somebody at Centenary. So they asked me up, and I started with Flannery O'Connor, who's an incredibly wonderful short story writer whose themes are profoundly religious. Fred Buechner, who I love and whom everybody connected with churches loves. Fred is a novelist and essayist who's written about 30 books. And then Walker Percy, the great Southern novelist from Louisiana. And so I did Flannery, and then I did Fred Buechner the next year, and then I did Walker Percy the third year, and then I had to keep coming up with more writers because they kept asking me back. So I did probably the most popular program I've ever done is a program on John Irving's novel, A Prayer for Owen Meany, which everybody absolutely loves that novel. And I did Owen Meany. Then I got really ambitious and I did Brothers Karamazov. And there was a wonderful young kid, like must have been like seventh or eighth grade, who came to my lectures and got absolutely fascinated. And there was an article in one of the Centenary publications about this wonderful boy who was reading Dostoevsky at this incredibly early age. And then when Reynolds Price died, I did a course, I think last year at Centenary, called Reynolds Price and Spirituality. And I did his wonderful book called A Whole New Life, his book about his cancer. And I did a novel, and I did some of his other memoirs. Reynolds, throughout his life, was very, very, very interested in spiritual questions. And this would be a good transition into Emily Dickinson, because Reynolds was not an institutional Christian. He called himself an outlaw Christian, meaning he was outside the law, outside the church. He loved Jesus. He wrote two books on the ethics of Jesus, and he was absolutely fascinated by the Gospels. Reynolds taught a course at Duke called Three Gospels, in which they read the Gospel of John, the Gospel of Mark, and they wrote their own Gospel based on the manuscripts that they studied. And Reynolds did his own Gospel and did his own translations of the Gospel of Mark and the Gospel of John. And he was so interested in this man called Jesus who had influenced history and people's spiritual lives so profoundly. But he didn't like the direction the church was going. When Reynolds was growing up, first of all, he was gay, and he was very quiet about it, and he was never uncomfortable about it himself, but he was very uncomfortable with the church's position. And he was also very uncomfortable with the church's position on race. And he grew up and he felt he could not be a member of a church which was so racially divided. And so he left the institution of the church, but he always called himself a Christian, though an outlaw Christian. So that's what I've talked about, Reynolds, his own faith and how it's expressed in his writing.
First off, I mean, given the broad scope of your career, you seem like the perfect fit for this sort of series at Centenary United Methodist Church. And I find that they're so good at bringing literature and this faith in films and
exactly.
Sparking conversations about life and death issues. I think of Ed Wilson's lecture series where he's talking about T.S. Eliot and his relationship with God.
I know Ed and
just wonderful.
You know, they also have me doing a poetry workshop. So in the fall, I do a 6-week poetry workshop at Centenary, and there's for 10 people. They're not always the same 10. And now I think we've done that for about 5 years because they decide, as you say, religion and film. And religion and the arts is a very strong program at Centenary. It's a wonderful church. And I've been very impressed with the open-mindedness and the thoughtfulness of the people at that church. But they keep having me back, so I have to keep coming up with new subjects.
Well, that was a great point of entry, that this, Reynolds Price's approach to faith and in his own life and kind of filtering it through his own experience. And Emily Dickinson is one, my initial recollection of her before I, kind of brushed up was this supreme dedication to faith and always wearing white, and it was all about God. But her relationship was very unusual. I mean, other than the first, what do they call that experience where people give themselves up to God, and she was among them, or as a young lady.
She couldn't do that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think what happened with Emily is that her family was very Orthodox, and the church in Amherst at that time would have been a Reformed church. Probably congregational, something similar to what would be Presbyterian. They went to church, and then they sent her off to Mount Holyoke, which was called then Mount Holyoke Female Seminary, which had just opened. And there was the revival there, and all the girls were turning to God and giving their lives and being literally being saved. I mean, it was a kind of a part of the Great Awakening, I guess. And she couldn't do it because she felt like there was a part of her that was very skeptical, that couldn't buy all this. And there was a part of her that always wanted to be a poet. And she felt like if she gave herself completely to God, completely to Christ in the way that these people were doing it, she would have to give up a part of herself, that she was not that part of herself, which was part of her own integrity. And she had, I would call it, who used that phrase? I love it. A lover's quarrel with the world. Sounds like Robert Frost. But Emily had a lover's quarrel with God. She loved God and hated God at the same time, and she felt that God was very unjust, and she felt that God was tyrannical, and that God was associated with the paternalistic culture of her time and was giving everybody orders, And she was a person who wanted to have her own. Her decision to wear white was her decision that this is to say, this is who I am. I am not one of them. They all believe this. I have to, in my poetry, wrestle out my own faith in words. It's like Reynolds. She wants to work outside. She stopped going to church, but she never stopped writing about issues of faith and problems of faith. And she's torn between wanting to believe and not being able to believe. And so that's what I want to look at in the poems, is the way she wrestles through those issues in different poems.
How does death, her obsession with the mortality, factor into that wrestling, her the losses that she experienced throughout her life, that sort of thing?
Well, I think it's very central because she was surrounded by death. People died a lot younger in those days. And in Amherst, I think there's one point where Emily says, In one of the houses she lived in, not the one that's now the Dickinson Museum, but the one that's no longer there that she lived in, she could look out the window and see the cemetery. And literally, there were people dying almost daily. I mean, and a lot of young people died. Her nephew died. It absolutely broke her heart. And I think that the terrible unfairness of early death, of lives being cut off, I think made her very, very unhappy and troubled her. Yeah, I mean, I think that was part of her own wrestling. I mean, that's the question. Why does God let this happen? Why would God create a world in which there is so much pain and so much suffering?
One thing that's always fascinated me about her was this steely strength and this ultimate vulnerability. This, she was devastated by the loss of her dog after 16 years, never quite recovered from that, and yet she's able to put out her work, have the inner faith that what she's doing is worthy, and stick with these sorts of things.
She was very, very, very smart. I mean, her sister Vinnie, who sort of took care of her all her life, said, Emily's the smart one. Her mother was not well educated. Her father was a businessman. Her brother, Austin, was a lawyer, I think. I mean, they were all practical. Emily was the intellectual, and she read profusely. I mean, she had a very, very, very strong mind. And she started writing her poetry the way she wanted to write it, and she stuck to it. She wrote these poems, put them away in her drawer, and she put them in these little volumes she stitched together called fascicles, and most of them were never seen by anybody until she died. Mm-hmm. The ones that were seen were the ones that got published and she often sent them out in letters, and people didn't know what to make of her because she was essentially beyond them. And when she sent poems out, people tried to correct them and print and make them neater and make the rhymes more perfect. And she was deliberately using half rhymes and slant rhymes and slightly irregular meter.
And capitalizations where they wouldn't ordinarily be. And
well, capitalization then was a different issue because in Emily's time, most substantive nouns were capitalized still. Hmm. So that her capitalization isn't as weird as her metrics. Hmm. But she loved the hymns of the church, and she uses as her basic meter for most of her poems what we would call hymn meter, which is, you know, da 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 da. O God, our help in ages past, our hope for years to come, our shelter from the stormy blast and our eternal home. That's Isaac Watts. Well, here's Emily. Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. You hear the beat?
Sure.
The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality. Well, but then the next line will be irregular. And that's what she would start out and she would use these irregularities that the ordinary poets of the day would say, well, you can't do that. And she would say, why not? In a sense, there were two people who made modern poetry in America. One was Emily Dickinson. The other was Walt Whitman. And they were both geniuses of a very different sort, and both took poetry in directions it had never been before. Mm. And Emily tried to stay within form but move it forward. And in a sense, she kind of invents modern poetry in America because she makes the form so much more flexible.
Could you give an example of just a stanza in which you have the juxtaposition of the hymnody setting and then it's juxtaposed against a rhythmic shift?
Here's my favorite short Emily Dickinson poem. It's the poem that's used in the movie Sophie's Choice. And at the end, when Sophie and Nathan are found in the bed together, and Stingo recites this Emily Dickinson poem for them. Listen to this. Ample make this bed with awe. In it wait till judgment break, excellent and fair. Be its mattress straight, be its pillows round. Let no sunrise yellow noise interrupt this ground. So she rhymes, ample make this bed with awe. In it wait till judgment break, excellent and fair. So she rhymes awe and fair, which is not, and they would say, well, why is she doing that? Listen, let no sunrise yellow noise interrupt this ground. No poet in America had ever condensed language like that. Mm. Let no sunrise yellow noise. And you try to say that in prose, you'd have to say, Well, don't let the noise from all the things that start waking up when the sun rises. You know what I mean?
No, I know exactly what you mean. There she is using, how often was it used, that sort of synesthesia, yellow noise?
Exactly. No, people weren't doing it. So she's very inventive with her language, and she'll vary the beat in order to get an effect.
I mean, I could talk Emily Dickinson all. I'm learning so much. I appreciate that. I do find a wonderful parallel, and there are several, and you're going to tell me more of them, but between Emily Dickinson and Mary Oliver, and that these images of nature, and it's much more than just
absolutely,
nature.
It's
the backbone of who we are as humans.
I think Mary Oliver is a lot easier to read for people. One of the things about Mary Oliver is that people who don't like poetry like Mary Oliver. And so she reaches an audience that, you know, if you say there are probably two major poets in America right now who can do that. And one is Mary Oliver, the other is Billy Collins, who can reach a general audience who don't generally read poetry. And I think her language is very simple, very accessible, very open, and extraordinarily honest. I love the absolute honesty of Mary Oliver. One of my favorite poems of hers is called Wild Geese. And the first line of that poem is, "You don't have to be good." See, I think that's Emily would love that, wouldn't she? You don't have to be good. You don't have to walk on your knees through the desert for 100 miles repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Isn't that something?
Oh.
"Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine," she says. And that's just pure Mary Oliver. And what she's saying is, no matter who you are, no matter how different you are, no matter whether you're a lesbian, as I am, you know, which she never comes out and says until much later, she's much more open about it. Mm-hmm. No matter who you are, God's created world is here for you. She says, whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination. And so what she's saying is, what do I do every day? I go out and I walk through the world. I watch and I pay attention and I write what I see. And everything is there for us. It's given to us. And we have to open our eyes and our hearts and our imaginations to it. And that's exactly the same thing that Dickinson did in her own way. And I think for Mary Oliver, life should be, I love what she says in one poem. There are three things you need to do as a writer. You have to pay attention, be astonished, and tell about it.
Mm.
So you got to go out there. You got to pay attention. You got to be astonished by what you see. And then you have to be able to find the language to describe that astonishment.
The sense of awe in this moment and getting most out of life comes across, too. And this is from Summer Day, where she writes, "Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Yeah. Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?"
Exactly.
Live today. And you both share a birth year, 1935. So she's 78 years old now, child of the 50s rather than child of the 60s. But the impact she's had, and a Pulitzer Prize winner to boot, so recognized in her own lifetime for what she's given.
Absolutely. And she's made this world of Provincetown. There's a beautiful national park right near where she lives, and she gets up. It's interesting with Mary Oliver, she's saying is, you don't have to go to Europe. You don't have to go all over the world. You don't have to see the Rocky Mountains. I have this place right near my home, and I go out, and I can see the ponds and the birds and the waves. And I can take my dog, Percy, who's named for Shelley, you know, I can take my and walk on the beach. And I have a world right here. You know, she says in that same poem of Summer Day, she says, I don't know exactly what a prayer is, but I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to lie in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? No, that, and then it comes to your line, doesn't everything die at last? In other words, Whitman says in Song of Myself, you know, I loaf and invite myself. And he looks at a spear of summer grass. And that's what Whitman is, Mary Oliver's great hero poet, you know, and he lies in the grass and looks at a spear of grass and reflects upon it. And that's what she strolls through the fields, seeing what she can see. And then she finds this grasshopper that she really looks at, you know, and it's wonderful. And what she teaches us is the sacredness of all life. And I think that's what our culture today is really missing. It's what I call sacramentalism. That is, you know, we learn in church a sacrament is an outward and visible sign of an inward and spiritual grace. Sacramentalism is the belief that objects are holy because they embody the divine and other people embody the divine, that we are all elements of the divine. And Mary Oliver tries to see that in her poetry every day. And she begins in her later poetry to come back to using some of the language of the church, because she and her friend Molly Malone Cook, you know, and when Molly died...
It's 2005 or something.
Yeah, 2005. The funeral was in a Episcopal church in Provincetown. And both Molly and Mary Oliver were very close friends of Bishop Shaw of Massachusetts, who had been one of the great fighters for the recognition of gay rights. And Bishop Shaw, I think, had helped to teach both Mary and Molly that the church was not as against them as they had feared it was at one time. And I think she begins to use the language of the Bible, the language of the prayer book in her poems, as well as the language of nature in her late poems. In her wonderful book called Thirst, which is published just after Molly Malone's death. So I feel like, gosh, those two would have a wonderful conversation, wouldn't they? Couldn't you imagine? That would be something to write a dialogue between the two of them.
There's a book right there.
Well,
because we didn't even talk about the wonderful letters that, you know, that Emily Dickinson would write 300 letters in a lifetime to people that she adored, and it was not uncommon.
Because that's all there was. Mm. And they were taken away from her. I think she felt there were so many young women that she grew up with that went to Amherst Academy with her and then moved away from Amherst, some of her very dearest friends. And she felt this terrible loss. And that's where those incredible letters to Thomas Wentworth Higginson come from, that she writes, she's looking for a mentor. And she writes to Higginson, "Are you too busy to see if my poetry is alive?" You know, and she sends these letters, and he doesn't know what to make of her poetry. But he does help her. He doesn't reject her. He suggests perhaps she's wise not to publish because the public isn't ready for these poems.
But she had already been published at that point.
But she had, but not the whole body of poems.
Sure.
She had been writing, I think it was 61, 62 she wrote to. And Higginson eventually visited her in Amherst, and she must have come down the stairs in her white dress and talk to him. And the next day he writes his wife. He's a nervous wreck. He says, being in the same room with Emily, there's so much electrical power in that room. And her language, if you look at her language is so unique and individual. He doesn't know how to deal. He says, it's sort of like, I don't know what to make of this. She's just one of the extraordinarily unique human beings. And, you know, all those people in Amherst, I'm sure, talked about her, that strange Emily Dickinson. And now she's the one we remember, and the rest of them.
That's great. This was fun, Tony. Thank you so much for coming and chatting with me. I appreciate it.
Well, I enjoyed chatting with you. I enjoy doing these lectures and enjoy reciting poetry and talking about it. So we look forward to hearing about Emily Dickinson and Mary Oliver at Centenary Methodist.
We sure do.
In the month of March.